Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the December 9th, 2022 issue of the Week. On the cover drawing this week, we have Chinese President Xi Jinping. He's standing in a hallway in front of a door. It's a red door, and he's trying to hold it closed, but the hinges are popping off, and around the edges of the door you see arms and legs sticking through, and there are those familiar little COVID balls flying through the air. He's got sweat running down his forehead and a concerned look on his face. The headline is Rebellion in China: Why Xi Jinping's Zero COVID Policy May Be Doomed to Fail. That is our first main story. We'll start there. Chinese rise up over COVID restrictions. What happened? Demonstrators, angered to a boiling point by China's restrictive zero COVID policies, took to the streets and cities across China last weekend in a remarkable uprising that represented the nation's greatest civil unrest since the 1989 Tiananmen Square demonstrations. In Shanghai, Beijing, Chengdu, and at least six other cities, thousands of citizens clashed with police and called for an end to restrictions that have kept residents confined to their homes for months-long stretches, sometimes without adequate food and medicine. Many held blank sheets of paper in silent protest of government censorship laws. Some openly called for an end to President Xi Jinping's rule and Communist Party repression. "We want freedom," chanted a crowd in Beijing. "We don't want emperors." The spark for the protest was a fire in an apartment building that killed 10 in the western Xinjiang region, deaths protesters blamed on quarantine barricades, they said slowed rescue efforts. To quiet the demonstrations, police and paramilitary forces massed at protest sites, conducted spot checks of people's phones, and visited protesters' homes to warn them to desist. Officials made small moves to ease some COVID controls. In Guangzhou, for example, officials ended mandatory mass testing. But with infections hitting record numbers and hundreds of millions of Chinese lacking protection from vaccination or prior infection, China could suffer up to 2.1 million deaths if controls are lifted, the health analyst from Airfinity estimated. So the zero COVID policy remained in effect. "The prevention and control plan has withstood the test of practice," said a government official in the state-run People's Daily. What the editorial said: "Xi's zero COVID policy has hit a dead end," said the Washington Post. "Nearly 3 years of lockdowns have hurt the economy, shuttered factories, and left citizens furious and fed up. Now Xi faces a wrenching choice for a dictator: whether to change, admitting failure, or to stick with a failing policy. Shifting gears could yield a calamity," said National Review. "Zero COVID has created a populace with little natural immunity, and because nationalistic Chinese authorities refuse to import effective Western mRNA vaccines, its only protection is from China's inferior vaccines. Meanwhile, the government's failure to broadly vaccinate the elderly, with only an estimated 40% of residents over 80 receiving boosters and millions left unvaccinated, has put China's most vulnerable population at high risk of death." What the columnist said: "After nearly 3 years of harsh pandemic restrictions, something cracked," said Li Wan in the New York Times. "The young people I interviewed said they were angry over forced testing and lockdowns that kept him isolated from friends and family. But their discontent goes beyond that, all the way to questioning Xi's iron-fisted rule. China's future looks increasingly bleak. Unemployment is high and state censorship has killed nearly all fun, with limited access to social media, games, books, and movies. I think all of these have reached a tipping point, said Miranda, a journalist in Shanghai. This is a crisis of Xi's own making, said Michael Schumann in The Atlantic. Zero COVID fended off an enormous crisis at a time when China faced an unknown virus with no vaccines. But as other countries vaccinated their populations and learned to manage COVID, Xi refused to change course and continued brutal restrictions such as business closures, mandatory quarantines, and even separating infected children from parents. He now has two bad options. He could ease off at a cost to his authority and possibly at the risk of uncontrolled COVID outbreak, or he could crack down harder, possibly inviting even greater resistance from the public. Capitulation seems unlikely, said Matthew Brooker in Bloomberg. Xi's instincts are to be uncompromising in dealing with any challenge to the party's grip on power. That carries a risk of trapping the country in a loop of escalating repression and resistance. But it's more likely the astonishing uprising of the past week will fade. Xi has fearsome tools of surveillance and social control at his disposal. Let's not forget, though, an ancient proverb once cited by Mao Zedong, a single spark can start a prairie fire. Controversy of the week, gun violence. Would new laws matter? To a nation already exhausted by a historic stretch of gun violence, the Thanksgiving break was no break at all, said John Woodrow Cox in the Washington Post. In the space of 10 days, we woke on three mornings to another high-profile shooting and a new death toll. Three University of Virginia football players were shot and killed by a disgruntled fellow student on a bus. A gunman armed with an AR-15 slaughtered five patrons and wounded 17 during a drag show at a Colorado LGBTQ bar. And back in Virginia, a Walmart supervisor opened fire in a break room and killed six co-workers and injured four others. And those were just the shootings that made the headlines. Already this year, we've seen 617 mass shootings, those with at least four killed or wounded, or roughly two mass shootings every day, double the number from an equivalent period in 2018. Factor in the 110 people shot to death each day in suicides, accidents, and homicides, and we're on pace to approach last year's record-setting total of 47,000 gun deaths. After the Walmart massacre, an emotional President Biden called it sick that we're awash in semi-automatic guns, said Paul LeBlanc in CNN.com, and he renewed his call for a federal assault weapons ban. But with many Americans and Republican legislators viewing gun ownership as sacrosanct, an escape from our cycle of violence seems unlikely. The number of mass shootings is indeed horrifying, said Kevin Williamson in the Dispatch. But why not enforce the laws we already have? Democrat-run cities are more concerned with reform than with putting criminals who use guns in prison. In Philadelphia, for example, 61% of gun arrests are now dismissed without prosecution, up from 30% in only 2016. Why this strange apathy from people who demand assault weapons bans after every highly publicized atrocity? Millions of these scary black rifles are in circulation because middle-aged bubbas like to shoot them for fun. Only a tiny percentage are used in homicides, the vast majority of which are committed with handguns. To reduce gun violence, crack down on urban criminals, not law-abiding gun owners. Wait, it's Democrats who won't enforce gun laws, said Tim Miller in the Bulwark. The massacre in Colorado could have been prevented if local police had followed the state's so-called red flag law and kept the shooter, who threatened to murder his mother last year, from acquiring an AR-15. But 37 Colorado sheriffs have declared their county's Second Amendment sanctuaries and refused to enforce the most common-sense gun law imaginable. Democrats may not be able to overcome a GOP Senate filibuster to the assault weapons ban already passed in the House, said the Las Vegas Sun in an editorial, but they should bring it to the Senate floor anyway. After so many school massacres, let's hear Republicans explain why Uncle Bob's right to possess an AR-15 is more important than little Timmy's right to survive the first grade. Gun violence is 25 times higher in America than in any other developed democratic nation, said Sentinel Colorado in an editorial. And we choose this nightmare by doing nothing. If dozens of other advanced democracies have figured out how to protect the rights of hunters and sportsmen without having to endure constant heartbreaking carnage, it's hard to fathom anything more un-American than the cynical idea that we are helpless. So, good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for the U.S. men's soccer team, which advanced to the next round of the World Cup by beating Iran 1-0. Before the game, the U.S. Soccer Federation posted an image of an Iranian flag without the Islamic Republic's emblem to support protesters in Iran. It was a good week for rebranding, with an announcement by the World Health Organization that the globally circulating virus known as monkeypox will henceforth be called Mpox, to make the name less racist and stigmatizing. And it was a good week for McNuggets, after a woman went into labor in an Atlanta McDonald's restroom and three staff members helped deliver a healthy baby daughter. Franchise owner Steve Eckenborough called it the epitome of a feel-good moment for my team. But it was a bad week for going with the flow, that's F-L-O-E, after about 200 ice fishermen and women had to be rescued from a chunk of ice that broke away and floated out into Minnesota's Upper Red Lake. The local sheriff's office warned winter anglers that early season ice is very unpredictable. It was a bad week for compensation, with the news that Russian authorities have been consoling the mothers of soldiers killed in Ukraine with a cardboard gift pack of not one, but three handsome towels. And it was a bad week for the Swiss, after Switzerland's energy minister suggested the nation's famously reserved citizens conserve energy by taking showers together. After some pushback, Simonetta Sommaruga clarified that her advice was aimed at young people and that after a certain age, showering together is no longer suitable. The title of the briefing today is If China Invades Taiwan. After decades of threats, is China preparing to attack and annex the island nation? Why would China invade? China has long claimed sovereignty over Taiwan and aimed for reunification with the island nation of 24 million people, located just 110 miles across the Taiwan Strait. The two have been separate entities since the Chinese Civil War in 1949, when Mao Zedong's Red Army defeated the forces of Chinese nationalist Chiang Kai-shek, who fled to Taiwan and set up an authoritarian government there. After Chiang's death in 1975, the island transitioned into a prosperous democracy. It is now led by President Tsai Ing-wen, of the pro-independence Democratic Progressive Party. And the vast majority of the nation's citizens do not want to come under Beijing's repressive rule. But Chinese President Xi Jinping sees Taiwan as he did Hong Kong, a natural part of China, stolen by pro-Western forces. To complete China's great rejuvenation and become the world's leading power, Xi believes, China must reclaim territory it lost in the 19th and 20th centuries. Experts believe Xi sees a window of opportunity to invade that might close if Taiwan succeeds in arming itself with major help from the U.S. At some point, China will decide, we have to do this, a Biden administration official told The New Yorker, and they'll just look for a casus belli. What are the warning signs? As Xi strengthens his one-man grip on power, his rhetoric about national unification has taken on a more strident tone. China has recently ratcheted up military activity with increased patrols in the Taiwan Strait and intrusions into Taiwanese airspace. In the wake of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan last summer, China test-fired 11 ballistic missiles into waters surrounding the island and conducted a large-scale naval exercise to simulate a blockade and invasion. U.S. Admiral Philip Davidson, then head of Indo-Pacific Command, said last year China might invade Taiwan before 2027. Admiral Mike Gilday, the U.S. Navy's chief of naval operations, argued that it could happen before 2024. In October, Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned that China no longer finds the current situation acceptable and is determined to pursue reunification on a much faster timeline. A month later, President Biden met with Xi in Indonesia and stressed the U.S.'s opposition to China's threatening actions against Taiwan. Xi warned Biden the Taiwan question is at the very core of China's core interests. What would an attack look like? An invasion would likely start with Chinese cyber and missile attacks on military infrastructure. After that, China's navy, which now rivals the U.S.'s in strength, would send an armada across the strait to mount a huge amphibious assault. The island's geography would pose myriad problems for China's People's Liberation Army, the PLA. Most of Taiwan's shoreline is unsuitable for ships to dock and upload personnel and equipment, and a 245-mile-long mountain range from the nation's northern tip to the southern end would serve as a natural obstacle to invading troops. A less costly option would be for China to attempt a naval blockade, cutting the island off from food and energy imports. In 2 weeks, Taiwan would start to go dark, Richard Chen, Taiwan's former deputy defense minister, told The New Yorker. No electricity, no phones, no internet, and people would start to go hungry. But a war would also likely lead the U.S. and other Western nations to cut off trade with China, which imports more food than any other country to feed its 1.4 billion people. Is Taiwan prepared to defend itself? No, Taiwan has about 200,000 active duty soldiers, airmen, and sailors, compared with the PLA's estimated 2 million. If necessary, Taiwan could call up its 400,000 reservists, but it lacks the weapons and infrastructure required to turn them into an effective fighting force. Taiwan is taking some steps to harden its defenses, though. The government approved $8 billion in emergency defense spending this year. It has also purchased $14 billion of military hardware from the U.S., but it hasn't been delivered yet because the war in Ukraine has left the U.S. with empty warehouses. For now, some civilians are taking matters into their own hands and learning basic civil defense. Robert Tsao, a Taiwanese billionaire, has dedicated over $30 million to a territorial defense program. I don't care if the government isn't ready, he said. We have to act. Would the U.S. get involved? Almost certainly. Biden has strongly implied that the U.S. would help defend the island against an attack. When U.S. military officers stage war games to act out the various scenarios of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, they usually end badly for the U.S. In extreme scenarios, the U.S. attacks mainland China, and then China attacks Hawaii and Alaska. In virtually all scenarios, a U.S.-China war over Taiwan would be devastating for both sides and the world. A war would fundamentally change the character and complexion of global power, said Matthew Pottinger, an Asia specialist at the Hoover Institution. If Taiwan falls, we are in a different world, where the tide of authoritarianism becomes a flood. Global economic repercussions. Taiwan manufactures about 70% of the global supply of advanced semiconductors, the chips that power smartphones, cars, and computers. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has spent about $300 billion on Taiwanese chips. Even China relies on them and lacks the expertise and infrastructure to produce its own. In the case of an occupation, China would need to force Taiwanese workers to operate the semiconductor factories, but without Western imports of raw materials and equipment, production would quickly cease. A world without Taiwan is a world back to the Stone Age, a semiconductor executive said. Combined with disruptions to shipping lanes in the Western Pacific, used by about one-third of the world's sea traffic, this could spur a global economic crisis. A Rand Corporation study predicted that a year-long war would cut the U.S.'s gross domestic product by 5 to 10%, but it would slash China's by 25 to 35%. Moving into a few of the best columns of the week. The first two are from the U.S., starting with the GOP's lost generation. Republicans are aghast at the stunning decline of support for the GOP among younger voters, said Jeff Jacoby. In House races, voters under 30 supported Democrats by a staggering 28-point margin. Why? Some of my conservative colleagues are blaming indoctrination by left-wing professors, while ignoring the elephant in the room, Donald Trump. No president in memory has so alienated younger voters with his repellent rhetoric and barbaric behavior. And these voters form their political identities. They saw Republicans defend and even celebrate a boorish, insult-spewing narcissist. As a result, an entire generation is probably lost to the GOP for good. This wasn't inevitable. In the 2000 election, voters under 25 were evenly split between George W. Bush and Al Gore. When Ronald Reagan ran for re-election in 1984, he got a stunning 61% of the vote of 18 to 24-year-olds. Though Reagan was 73, he won them over with his sunny optimism and a deep-rooted faith in the goodness of ordinary Americans. If Republicans want a chance with the next generation of young voters, they will need candidates who promote an uplifting conservative vision rather than Trumpist resentment and hatred. I'm not holding my breath. Post-Roe horrors at hospitals. Just as doctors like me warned, said Shabby Ease Karkowski, abortion bans are creating medical nightmares for women experiencing dangerous pregnancy complications. A recent medical journal article describes this new reality in Texas, where abortion laws prohibit doctors from intervening unless there's an immediate threat to maternal life. At two major hospitals, 28 pregnant women experienced serious complications at less than 22 weeks gestation. Their agonized obstetricians were forced to wait for something terrible to happen for an average of 9 days as the women suffered. During those pointless delays, 27 of the pregnancies ended in miscarriages. The one surviving baby had massive complications, including brain swelling and bleeding and liver and lung dysfunction, guaranteeing a short life with major disabilities. Most of the 28 women suffered dangerous medical complications, some serious enough to require intensive care admission, surgery, or a second admission to the hospital. One patient had to get a hysterectomy. If the patients had had the option of terminating these doomed pregnancies, much of this misery could have been avoided. But of course, in Texas, these women didn't get a choice. This column comes from Uganda, where kids take on adult responsibility. Ugandan children are growing up way too fast, said Mabel Twigumi Zaki. Many drop out of school to pay the bills or take care of younger siblings. Psychologists call this parentification, when kids are forced to take on adult roles in the household. I witnessed it just the other day when I got a flat tire. The mechanic who came to my aid was a short, skinny young boy clad in an oversized dark blue coverall. Just 8 years old, the boy told me most of his siblings worked because, he said, we have to help put food on the table. The problem stems from the collapse of Uganda's traditional community-based model of child rearing. In the old days, the parents were only part of a child's upbringing. Extended family and the rest of the village also had clear-cut complementary roles to play. We believed then that a child is like a goat. It needs constant vigilance to tame it. But colonialism and the rise of the cult of individualism shattered the foundational fabric of the extended family, replacing it with the nuclear family. Now, if one parent dies or the family finances fail, it's goodbye innocence. Parentified children may seem impressively mature, but 8-year-olds shouldn't be looking after entire families. Our kids deserve a true childhood. The Last Word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Work Transformed. After decades of having their jobs control their lives, workers are demanding more freedom, said Helene Olin in the Washington Post. Americans are still figuring out what that means. In February 2020, few would have predicted the wave of dissatisfaction that was about to roll over the American workplace. The United States, it was common to say, was a nation of workaholics, and we seemed to like it that way. Our professional lives had taken on the overtones of a secular religion. They were a primary way to find meaning in the world and a crucial part of our identity. We were married to the job, in the words of therapist and author Eileen Phillipson. Even precarious, low-paying gigs were valorized as hustle culture, representing freedom to perform labor on our terms. Fast forward to fall 2022. The number of people quitting, while down from the peak, remains at the highest level since the 1970s. White-collar workers don't want to give up working remotely. Low-paying sectors, such as the hospitality industry, can't find enough people willing to work for the wages on offer. Union organizing and strikes have been on an upswing. Myriad commenters have tried to name the collection of trends underway. The Great Resignation, the Great Renegotiation, Quiet Quitting, the Great Reevaluation. It's not easy to nail down a movement that spans striking nurses and unionizing strippers, Amazon warehouse workers, and work-from-home Wall Street bankers. But what's increasingly clear is that the March 2020 decision to partially close down the American economy shattered Americans' dysfunctional, profoundly unequal relationship with work like nothing in decades. And even if there was great discomfort in a shutdown that severed almost every one of us from assumptions about how we earn a living, we also found an unexpected opportunity to remake our relationship with the labor that fills our days. To understand what happened, it's helpful to divide the 164 million Americans who were in the labor force in February 2020 into three rough categories. There were the millions who thought they possessed a secure job, only to be laid off or furloughed as the pandemic lockdown set in. There were white-collar office workers who continued to work 40 or more hours a week, but now from home. Then there were the workers, grocery store employees, food service workers, and utility workers, as well as police officers, postal workers, teachers, and healthcare providers, whose work was suddenly dubbed essential, without whose efforts society as we knew it would cease to function. All these groups saw their relationship with their employers suddenly upended. At the same time, parents, especially women, experienced a huge increase in responsibility at home as schools and childcare shut down. From there, the three groups' fates diverged. The first group, exiled from their jobs, found themselves scrambling for a paycheck and a sense of meaning, but ultimately found their finances buttressed by everything from an expansion of unemployment to a student loan payment moratorium. The second, many of whom previously spent more time with their work, families than their real ones, found themselves working within their own homes. Minus commutes and pesky workplace interruptions, though often plus the presence of children, many found they had free time to bake bread, engage with pandemic pets, or take on increasing household tasks. The third cohort, more likely to be black or Latino, more likely to be lower income, were left to labor in person. Some got temporary boosts in pay, but these were mostly rescinded after several months. They were more likely to get exposed to the coronavirus and to be among the more than 1 million Americans who died of COVID-19. All of it, the lockdowns, the disease, the sudden change in household functioning, and how or whether we worked at all, amounted to a massive psychological shock, leading many to ask why labor looms so large in our psyches. It really was an opportunity, an unwelcome opportunity, to take a look at the mad scramble that many of us have just assumed was normal, said Kate Schindel, who, as president of the Actors Equity Association, represents a particularly hard-hit industry. Then, when the economy unexpectedly boomed back, Americans were poised to pivot. As many had recognized, it was one thing to seek meaning in work, but another to see our lives subsumed by it. And for what? A less than adequate paycheck? A job that could literally kill you? Maybe the poor safety net really kept people from analyzing the role of work in their lives. David Bluestein, author of The Importance of Work in an Age of Uncertainty, and a professor at Boston College's Lynch School of Education and Human Development, told me, maybe the American work ethic was a form of survival. The United States has a long history of labor unrest. We weren't simply given the 8-hour workday, minimum wage, and laws protecting union organizing. They came about after decades of strikes and worker advocacy. Together, measures such as these helped bring prosperity and security to workers following World War II. But within a few decades, business interests reasserted themselves. When President Ronald Reagan fired striking air traffic controllers in 1981, it signaled a profound change in the balance of power. As inequality soared, work conditions deteriorated. The number of high-earning men who put in more than 50 hours a week at work increased sharply. College graduates spent more time on the job than those who didn't graduate high school. Others, mainly low-wage workers, worked contingent schedules, unable to plan for child care or know whether they'd earn enough to pay for it. American worker protections fell behind those of other industrialized countries, with a federal minimum wage adjusted for inflation peaking when the Bee Gees were still charting hits. Today, there is still no national law guaranteeing a single day of paid vacation or sick leave. A 2019 Gallup survey found that when you measure everything from pay to control over the work environment, security and happiness, barely 4 in 10 employed Americans could be described as having a good job. And we wanted one more than almost anyone, even ourselves, realized. Over and over, when people spoke to journalists, including me, about why they'd made changes in their professional lives since March 2020, they told us they liked receiving better wages when they were switched employers. But even more, they wanted greater control over the terms of their labor. Peter Contreras, comparing a prior furniture store management position with his current one in sales, told me about his better compensation, easier commute, and a boss who understands he sometimes wants to adjust his schedule to see his children play sports. Or take Colton Smith, who was working at an investment bank in New York when the pandemic hit. You get a lot of time in the apartment to yourself. You're FaceTiming with family and friends, he told me about his decision to quit his job last year and bike across the country. You start to remember what life is about. He's now seeking a job in augmented reality. Business startups soared. Lindsay Scola quit her job with a Los Angeles talent agency to consult for celebrities and businesses on social impact investing and advocacy. Pre-pandemic, I was just one of those people running as fast as I could, she said. Going out on her own, she said, allowed her to set up my life in a way that worked better for me. Others decided to stick with their jobs, but fight to make them better. The pandemic catalyzed some high-publicity union campaigns, with new young leaders emerging. When Amazon warehouse assistant manager Christian Smalls was fired after organizing an employee walkout to protest a lack of COVID protections, he went on to found a union that won the first successful authorization vote at one of the company's warehouses. Where unions were already present, they pressed for better pay and treatment. Nurses in Minnesota went on a 3-day strike in September, asking for not only a pay raise, but also an end to understaffing that, they said, put patients' lives at risk. Though these group efforts got attention, even more Americans revolted against work culture individually. Considering the supposed phenomenon of quiet quitting, rallying their peers on YouTube and TikTok, Gen Zers proclaimed they would perform assigned duties only during official work hours and say no when asked to take on extra tasks in the name of getting ahead. Scolds were aghast, but as others pointed out, this type of quitting is what used to be known as working full-time. And the newly remote workers? As companies announce return-to-office plans, they have encountered significant pushback from employees who say they are both happier and more productive at home. Increasingly, corporate honchos are taking a stand not at 5 days of in-person work, but 3. Take financial giant BlackRock, where Chief Executive Larry Fink's hard line for employees is a hybrid model. This is an enormous victory for many office workers, and one almost nobody could have imagined in February 2020. The new order still faces headwinds. An increasing number of companies, including Meta, are carrying out layoffs, while others are slowing hiring and upping performance expectations on those currently employed. Jerome H. Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve, said he would most likely continue to raise interest rates, but acknowledged there will very likely be some softening of labor market conditions. Employers are clearly feeling emboldened. Goldman Sachs is insisting all employees report to the office 5 days a week. No ifs, ands, or buts. For all the attention paid to new union organizing at places such as Starbucks, overall membership continues to fall. A cynic will recall we've been here before. The 1970s also saw union activism and questioning of the meaning of work. It's the decade that turned the career guide, What Color Is Your Parachute?, into a bestseller, only for both to crash and burn in the 1980s. But there are crucial differences between then and now. An increased level of remote work, likely in a hybrid format, is almost certainly to stay, says Nick Bloom, a professor of economics at Stanford University, who has studied the topic for decades. Employees want it. Technological advances continue to make it easier. And companies that forbid it completely are likely to find themselves at a disadvantage. And while labor laws need to be updated for our new reality, from protections for remote workers, yes, you should be paid for that email you sent after dinner, to long-sought changes to empower union organizing, states are beginning to step into the breach. California, for instance, recently enacted legislation to set up a council governing conditions and pay for fast food workers. Perhaps most important, demographic trends favor today's workforce. In 1990, about 20% of the workforce was over the age of 50. Now, 1 in 3 workers fall into that cohort. One recent working paper posted on the National Bureau of Economic Research website found a large percentage of the workers who exited the job market during the pandemic were baby boomers, with some retirements pushed up by the pandemic. The main beneficiaries? Younger workers, now having an easier time getting promoted. The past 2.5 years brought immense upheaval, and we'll be struggling to process the resulting changes for years. But it's undeniable that some of these shifts were long overdue. Workers are highly unlikely to forget what we learned, namely, that our jobs are much more flexible than we thought. And after decades of subservience to work, Americans have finally made significant strides towards restoring it to its proper role in our lives. Now it's our job to keep it there. This story was first published in the Washington Post. We're on the health and science page. Artemis 1's high orbit around the moon. NASA's Artemis 1 mission has successfully put its Orion spacecraft into orbit around the moon, reports the New York Times. Last week, the unmanned capsule carried out a lunar flyby, soaring within 81 miles of the surface, the closest it will get, and taking some spectacular photos. Then it burned its engines to enter a distant retrograde orbit, traveling in the opposite direction of the moon's orbit of Earth, 40,000 miles from the surface, reaching its farthest point 270,000 miles from Earth, farther than any other spacecraft designed to carry astronauts. The previous record, some 248,000 miles from Earth, was set when the crippled Apollo 13 craft had to swing around the moon. There was a hiccup along the way. The spacecraft lost communications with Mission Control in Houston for a tense 47 minutes, but engineers soon restored the link. Once the capsule's 25-day journey is complete, it will head back to the Earth and splash down in the Pacific. The mission is the first step in the Artemis program, which aims to return astronauts to the moon and establish a lunar base. Artemis II, a crewed mission, is planned for 2024. In the following year, Artemis III will land astronauts on the moon. So far, it is all going to plan. I would give it a cautiously optimistic A+, says project leader Mike Serafin. Dangers of repeat COVID. Your second bout with COVID may be worse than your first. Researchers at the Department of Veterans Affairs analyzed the health records of nearly 41,000 patients who had been infected two or more times. The median time between the first and second infections was just over half a year. Compared with people who had only one infection, the repeat patients were three times more likely to be hospitalized, twice as likely to die. They also had a threefold increased risk of heart issues and blood clotting conditions, and a twofold increased risk of fatigue. The findings applied regardless of whether they had been vaccinated or boosted. The results don't prove a causal relationship, and other research has suggested that reinfections become less severe over time. But study co-author Ziad Al-Ali from the VA St. Louis Healthcare System says the findings should encourage people not to be blasé about reinfection. Getting it a second time is almost like you're trying your chance again with Russian roulette, he tells the Washington Post. You may have dodged a bullet the first time, but each time you get the infection, you are trying your luck again. And we'll flip on over to the talking points page, starting with the article, Supreme Court, Cozy Ties to Religious Activists. The Supreme Court's conservative justices complain that critics question the legitimacy of their rulings, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate. But the reasons to doubt their impartiality are even greater than anyone suspected. The New York Times recently revealed that wealthy religious zealots paid money to pray with and socialize with and extract priceless personal favors from Supreme Court justices, including Samuel Alito, Clarence Thomas, and the late Antonin Scalia, even as those justices were hearing cases of great interest to the Christian right. Former evangelical leader Reverend Rob Schenck told the Times that in 2014, Alito revealed to activists Gail and Donald Wright of the group Faith and Action over dinner at his home that the religious objectors would be on the winning side of Burwell versus Hobby Lobby. That ruling exempted Christian-owned companies from providing contraception coverage in their health plans. Alito denies leaking but admits socializing with the Wrights. The real scandal is that Alito, Thomas, and Scalia allowed a massive influence network to spend times with them in their homes and pray with them in their chambers. Actually, this is nothing but another case of political intimidation, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Democrats are relentlessly attacking the court because they're bitter they've lost control of it. Schenck, now a pro-choice progressive, is an unreliable whistleblower who waited 8 years to make his charge against Alito. Democrats' concerns about the Supreme Court's ethics are just a smokescreen for their efforts to smear center-right justices. It's no smear to wonder why those justices have agreed with the Christian right in virtually every case, said Sarah Posner in MSNBC.com. Alito, Thomas, and Scalia repeatedly ruled that contraception, abortion, and LGBTQ rights infringed on the religious freedom of the conservative Christians who raised at least $30 million through Faith in Action to influence them. The fundamental problem is that the Supreme Court has no mandatory code of conduct, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Lower courts have one, but justices on the Supreme Court are left to make ethics decisions on their own, and they have given the public reason for its mistrust. Only 40% of Americans now approve of the court. It's time for the court to set transparent and firm ethical standards for itself. At stake is no less than its legitimacy. Twitter, Musk's clear political agenda. Elon Musk has gone down the right-wing rabbit hole, said Michael Hiltzits in the Los Angeles Times. Over the past 2 weeks, he's made it clear that the primary reason for his failing $44 billion purchase of Twitter was to use the platform to, in his words, establish an even playing field for far-right views and provide what he calls a counter-narrative to the woke mind virus. Last week, Musk announced that virtually all banned Twitter accounts would be restored, including those of white supremacists, anti-Semites, and misogynists. Traded approving tweets with election deniers like Dinesh D'Souza and anti-immigrant activist, and even tweeted an image of Pepe the Frog, a symbol of the racist alt-right. Musk used his platform to attack advertisers who'd fled Twitter and endorsed Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for president in 2024, calling him a sensible and centrist candidate. He even vowed to start a war with Apple for pulling its ads and claimed the company threatened to pull Twitter from its app store. Do they, Apple, hate free speech in America? Musk tweeted. I'm in for the Elon Musk revolution, said Michael Brendan Doherty in National Review. Under previous ownership, Twitter had become a tool of censorship and control by the commissars of the center-left establishment, and so had Facebook, Google, and virtually all of Silicon Valley. Not surprisingly, almost everyone in the establishment is firing back and putting pressure on advertisers to abandon Twitter. But the world's richest man will fight back, and it will be fascinating to watch as he tries to complete Twitter's successful exit from the wokarati. To understand Musk, you need to read libertarian author Ayn Rand, said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg. The protagonist of Rand's sophomoric novels are cartoons of what people like Musk, Jeff Bezos, and Peter Thiel all wish they would be. Visionary, superior beings who rebel against and burst the limits of the humdrum and stultifying mainstream. When little people get in the way, they crush them. Musk and his billionaire buddies have actually updated Rand, said Derek Robertson in Politico, and see themselves as avatars of tech libertarianism. They seek to undermine the cultural regime that they believe dominates the media, academia, and corporate governance. Musk's many critics believe he is destroying Twitter, but in his aggrieved, hyper-individualistic view, he is saving it and the country, too. And we'll finish out with some shorter notes, starting with nearly 30% of Americans now live alone, up from 13% in 1960. Among households headed by someone over 50, nearly 36% are single occupancy, as older Americans are now more likely to have been divorced, separated, or never married. Research links aging alone with shorter lifespans and diminished physical and mental health. At least 38 hospitals in rural Mississippi are at imminent risk of closure, state officials say. Despite its high number of poor, uninsured residents, the state has declined to expand Medicaid, and the COVID-19 pandemic overwhelmed hospitals with patients who could not pay for care. Among 700 protests where people showed up with firearms since 2020, 77% of gun carriers were promoting right-wing views. In open carry states, people are showing up at contentious public meetings carrying weapons. And at a campaign stop, an armed man confronted Texas Democratic gubernatorial candidate Beto O'Rourke, saying that he was not welcome in this town. Fox News aired an average of 141 weekday segments on violent crime each week from September until election week 2022. After the election, the number of violent crime stories on the network dropped by 50%. On the poll watch, 58% of Republicans and 48% of Democrats report having a meal with someone of another party in the past year. 79% of Democrats say they have very little or nothing in common with Republicans, while 74% of Republicans say the same about Democrats. 75% of Americans have used Facebook in the past 6 months, while just 34% report using Twitter or TikTok. 44% of social media users spend the most time on Facebook, compared with 8% on TikTok and 4% on Twitter. We've got time for a couple of quotes. We'll start with Carl Sagan. Through 99% of our time on Earth, we have been wanderers, and the next place to visit is Mars. And we'll finish with a quote from Joseph Campbell, who says, "If the path before you is clear, you're probably on somebody else's path." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.